Gemarach is Simatova. As we approach the Shabbos Shuv Drasha, Tavshin Pei Dalet, the new year, I want to take a moment by first of all thanking the sponsor, Hilary Storch, who is sponsoring the Shabbos Shuv Drasha in memory of her friend, Mazal Abadi, Mazal Bas Yedidah Daniel, and Freda. Ezrad Hashem Nishmosa Eden, she shared little Gan Eden, and our lineage should be a continued alias Neshama for her. Let us learn a little bit today. Today I'd like to talk about the topic of sabotage. It's a little bit of a funny topic. It doesn't sound like it's a very inspiring topic, but really it's about the subtitle. It's about why we keep doing things which we know are unhelpful for ourselves. I just noticed a comment, a post on BuzzFeed recently, which is entitled 19 Things That Even Healthy People Do That Are Actually Bad For You. And I was looking through the list, and there's different items on the list. And, you know, every year we look at them, and I'm sure that we associate with some of these ideas, whether it's constantly comparing ourselves to others, bringing your phone to bed, relying on social media and other people to affirm your self-worth, taking your anger and frustration out on your loved ones because they're an easy outlet. All these 19 different ideas, and I'm sure we all fall into these. But the truth is that even with BuzzFeed not being the paramount expression of academic integrity, then if you look at this on a health level, it's rather scary and sobering. Just as an example, about the amount of things that we as healthy people do which are not helpful for ourselves, which are destructive behaviors for ourselves. To put things into a sobering perspective. The CDC has a number of guidelines for prevention for disease prevention and health promotion. And in one of their fact sheets, they point out that as of now, 42% of all Americans have suffered from obesity. 20% of young people, that means people below the age of 19, which put them at a higher risk for heart disease, type 2 diabetes, and some cancers. Just to go a little further into this in this topic as well. People who are overweight or have obesity have an increased risk of type 2 diabetes compared to those who are healthy, because over time their bodies become less able to use the insulin they make. As of now, 96 million Americans, that's one in every three, have pre-diabetes, although only more than 8 out of 10 of those don't even know they have it as well. Going further, the CDC continues to say that when it comes to cancer, consuming unhealthy foods and beverages, sugar sweetened beverages, highly processed foods can lead to weight gain, obesity, and other chronic conditions, and put people at higher risk of at least 13 different types of cancer. These are all factually noted. And remember, it takes a long time to be able to have these studies actually prove not just correlation, but causation. And so the fact that we have these studies by the Center of Disease Control should be a very sobering reality. And yet, we still drink those drinks. We still eat those foods. If anything can last on our shelf without changing color or going bad for more than a week or two, then it's probably a ultra processed food. On that topic as well, unfortunately, just more in this topic. It's from the Mayo Clinic. The Mayo Clinic points out, with an article by Dr. Laskowski, that researchers have done 13 different studies about sitting. And they've found that a person who sits for more than 8 hours a day with no physical activity has a risk of dying similar to those that posed of by obesity and smoking. And this is research which has been done. We all do this. And we all sit at our desks and we're busy for good reason, and we've got important things to be doing, and yet we put ourselves at incredible health risks. Similarly, when it comes to consuming ultra-processed food, this is from the British Heart Foundation, a person who consumes ultra-processed food, this means things with preservatives, coloring, are more likely to be at greater risk for high blood pressure, cardiovascular disease, heart disease, and strokes, and early death. And they cite three studies, one done in Australia with 10,000 Australian women over 15 years, and they found that those who had the highest amount of ultra-processed foods were 39% more likely to develop high blood pressure than those with the lowest. Another analysis, which was done over 325,000 men and women, showed that those who ate the most ultra-processed foods were 24% more likely to experience serious heart and circulatory events, including heart attacks, strokes, and angina. Then in a test in 2019 with almost 20,000 graduate students in Spain, it showed that the participants were split into groups depending on the level of ultra-processed food intake. the groups with a fewer processed food intake, that means that they ate less than 2 servings per day, and the group that ate more than 4 servings per day had a difference in terms of 62% of the higher group were more likely to die at an average of 10.4 years earlier than the lower consumption group. Folks, these are real statistics. These are real measurements, and yet we still eat these things, and yet we still sit all day. And yet, and going further, Jonathan Haidt, who writes many articles, really an excellent writer, very incisive person, wrote an article actually just this year in February 2023, and he points out an interesting observation, and that is that in the year 2012, there was a huge spike in the increase in anxiety and mental health diseases among teenage girls. And the question became, why did this happen? Some people pointed to the global financial crisis coming out of the 2008 crisis affecting young teens at the time, but it doesn't make sense because countries like Canada, which were less affected by the downturn, were in fact saw the same level of effect as in Britain and America, other Western countries as well. And there have been many other financial crises in life, and the uptake in anxiety has not proven to be the same. The argument he makes is that for the simple reason, because it was in the year 2012 that Facebook bought Instagram, and that was the year when the user base exploded. It was also the year in which the iPhone 4 was released, the first smartphone with a front-facing camera, introducing the word to the human dictionary called selfie. It was at that time that young ladies, young girls, would spend hours upon hours taking selfies of themselves, editing selfies and posting selfies so friends, strangers and stalkers could comment on them and judge their worth based on their pictures, while they spent many other hours a day looking at the edited pictures of other people and celebrities who seem to lead much more extravagant lives and seem to have much more attractive, superior bodies to themselves, and measure themselves against that worth. All these hours taking time away from sleep, wholesome friendships, and being with family. And the argument that he makes in this article in February 2023 is the collaborative view with Gene Twenge, Zach Rausch, and I have put together collects more than 100 correlational longitudinal experimental studies on both sides of the question. Taken as a whole, it shows strong and clear evidence of causation, not just correlation. There are surely other contributing causes, but the collaborative review doc points strongly to the fact that the conclusion, social media is a major cause of the mental illness epidemic in teen girls. If you look at the graph in the notes, you'll notice that in the year 2012, there's a spike in anxiety, which affects anybody from the age of 18 to 25. There's an increase in people aged 20 to 26 to 34, and it's mostly static for those aged 35 to 49 and those aged 50 plus who are not digital natives, who are not as affected by the social media revolution as well. Folks, it's worth all reading more of his comments. He has an Atlantic article called The Last Decade of American History is Uniquely Stupid. It's really worthwhile reading about the impact of social media, and yet we're still on it. And yet we still binge social media. And yet we still give our children smartphones without any filters, without any regulations, without any curfews. Look at the research. And the question that I'd like to pose today is, why is it? Why is it when we know these things, we know that ultra-processed foods are bad for ourselves, we know sitting is bad, we know we need to do more exercise, we know social media is bad for ourselves, it's been proven and studies will continue to show it, and yet we continue to do it. Why do we sabotage ourselves? Why don't we take better care of ourselves? That's the question I'd like to address this in the Shabbos Shuvah Drasha. And in order to answer this, I'd like to point to three models. These are not an exhaustive study, but three models of why it is that we do this to ourselves and how we can perhaps better improve our lives going forward. The first model relates to two goats. And when you think about Yom Kippur, we always think about those two goats, the goats that appear in the base of Migdash, the one that is shechted and brought the blood brought into the Kodesh Kadoshim, and the other goat which is sent out with the Averis of Bnei Israel to the Tzuk, to the Midbar, to the desert. And yet, at the same time, there actually really is a third goat. And the argument I like to make is that based on The Rambam Ipanu has a Kabbalistic writing in which he makes the observation that there really is a third goat. The reason why we're sending the goat out to the desert, to this place called Azazel, is as a parallel to another episode that occurred in Tanakh much earlier. It was another person who was also sending a goat. And what goat was he sending? He was Yehuda. Yehuda, when you read Parshas Vayeshev, sends his friend Chira Isha Adulami, his friend who is from Adulam, and he sends him with a goat. Why does he send this man with a goat? The answer is because just previously he had consorted with what seemed to be a prostitute. He was not allowing his third and last son to marry his daughter-in-law, Tamar, as part of the act of Yibum, and she was therefore in a chained-up situation. She was not able to continue with her life, yet Yehuda was too scared to allow her to marry Shelah and perhaps lose his third and last son. And Yehuda pushed it off, and so she took the action into her own hands, and she dressed up and consorted with Yehuda. But he didn't have the fee to pay for that engagement, and so he leaves with her some of his personal belongings in order to wait until the collateral he can be exchanged for the payment, which is in fact the goat. And he sends off the goat afterwards in the hands of Chira, and Chira looks around and he searches, and the more he searches, the more he realizes that she's not there. And the people tell him, there was no prostitute in this place at all. Says the Rabbi Pano, that's what we do on Yom Kippur. On Yom Kippur we realize that as much as it seemed real to us, as much as it seemed that it was tangible and concrete, ultimately, it really was illusory. It never was. It was all smoke and mirrors. It was an oasis, a mirage that we saw in the hot desert heat. And it looked so real and appeared so real, and we hoped it was real, and it was pleasurable for a moment, but it really wasn't. And we send all our averas out and realize that all our averas are like that goat that's being sent, v'yenena. But it isn't. It's all an illusion. That's what happens over here. In fact, this idea is so powerful. It relates to the idea I recall seeing in the Mesiras Yesharim. Rav Moshe Chaim Lutzato makes this incredibly incisive observation. And I like to read it because it's so powerful. This is in the 15th chapter of Mesiras Yesharim, where he says at the very beginning the following observation. He says, Al-Kishi is Borer El Adam. When a person spends time, when they're spending a little time thinking to themselves, that which seems good to you is completely illusory. It's not consistent. It won't last. It's not going to be. But the bad that's contained in that illusion, is very real. And it's going to produce ultimately negative results. In such a case, you will not be seduced by it. You'll be much more careful. Cain, zeu kol hanimut shetzorich sheyilmad ha'adam esichla. A person should train themselves. La'akir b'chulshas ha'tanugim ha'ele v'shako shekrom ad sheme'elov yimaspom v'lo yikshe ve'enov l'shalka me'itoy. Should realize how false those things which are so alluring to us in life are. How empty they are compared to the results. And the Mesiras Yesharim says, I'll give you an example. Think about the food industry right now. The multi-billion dollar industry. Industry of advertising. The industry of ordering, of delivering, of consuming, of making events. Billions and billions of dollars. We spend most of our day just talking about food. Never mind eating it. And says the Mesiras Yesharim, how long is the pleasure of eating? How much time do we enjoy eating? It takes as long as it is possible to put an item in our mouth until we chew it a few times and swallow it. A few seconds. And even for us, who spend so much money and making reservations and going to fancy places and ordering out, how long do we even mindfully do with that? How much time do we even, just really, sparsely a few seconds. And then after that, after that is when we suffer. Then we have the indigestion. Then we have the sleepless nights. Then we have the weight. Then we have the repercussions. Hours, years of fixing what was a few seconds of an experience. Isn't that profound? And we do it all the time. It's not there. It's not real. It lasts a few seconds. And yet we keep doing it to ourselves. How many Motzei Shabbos do we not sleep because of indigestion, because we ate too much on Shabbos? We just put an extra plate full. Just because we had to finish the plate because it was there. Why? Why? It's all an illusion. There's a description, there's a beautiful article in New Yorker describing the life of a woman by the name of Carolyn Weitz. Carolyn Weitz now serves as a PhD program associate professor out west. She describes that she, when she was growing up at the age of 4, she went to the Bing Nursery School, which was on the campus of Stanford University. She was called out of class one day by a friendly person who said, "We're going to play a game." She goes off to a room which is hardly bigger than a closet, and she sat down at a table. The person explains to her, "We're going to play a special game, and you're going to get a treat. Do you like pretzels or cookies or marshmallows?" And she said, "Marshmallows." She really liked marshmallows, and she still does to this day. The person then said to her, "Look, here's what we're going to do. I'm going to give you a marshmallow, and I'm going to leave you with this marshmallow by yourself in this room. And if you want to, you can eat that marshmallow. But if you decide to wait until I come back, then I'll give you 2 marshmallows. If you don't eat it right now, I'll give you 2. And if you want, if you need me to come back, you can press this little bell over here. I'll come back in, but you only get 1 marshmallow then as well." And she was left in the room. Carolyn was a patient young lady. She was a person who managed to wait the 15 minutes before the researcher came back into the room. Craig, on the other hand, her older brother, who was 1 year older than her, did not have the same experience. He recalls the realization that there was no one left in the room. And not only did he have that marshmallow, but he took all the rest of the treats and ate them too. In fact, in another experiment where they offered him 1 toy versus 2 toys if he waited, he realized that the stash of toys that were still stored in the drawer, he broke open the drawer and cleared it out. After that, his teachers in the Bing Nursery School suggested that he didn't go to play that game anymore. But it is interesting to note that what became the famous experiments were known as the marshmallow experiments or the experiment of delayed gratification, led by Walter Mischel, actually a very fascinating individual, a Jew with a long history, which is worthwhile reading as to why this is so significant in his life journey. But nonetheless, he did this experiment with over 600 subjects of children between the ages of 4 and 6, and they found that most children, or average child, was not able to withstand the delayed gratification and ate the marshmallow within an average of 3 minutes. Those who managed to wait the 15 minutes, like Carolyn, were in fact 30% of the trial set. What was interesting is that after Walter Mischel conducted this, he would have conversations around the dinner table with his daughters. His daughters also went to the Bing, and they continued in the regular school system there in Stanford. And he'd ask them, how's Eric doing? How's Isabel? How's Jane? How are they doing in school? And he noticed something interesting. And that was that those who were the higher delayers, those who'd managed, like Carolyn, unlike Craig, to wait, were in fact seemed to be doing better at school. When his kids weighted them on a anecdotal 0 to 5 scale of how they were doing academically and socially, he found that those who were long delayers had seemed to be doing better overall. And this piqued his interest. He went back and he reached out to the over 630 participant families, and the kids were now in high school by this time, and started tracking them, and started asking SAT scores, acceptance to universities, social acceptance, extracurriculars, and he found consistently that one of the greatest markers for success in life was in fact delayed gratification, not intelligence. There are many intelligent people, but those who do not have the patience to exercise self-restraint, unfortunately, were less successful in life. As an example, Carolyn herself later on went to get a PhD and became an associate professor, whereas her brother Craig was still, as he described it, figuring things out later on in his career. What is interesting about it is that when they discovered this, and they replicated this many times, and they found this, even socioeconomic situations affected those who had tried. So doing this in the South Bronx, generally, on average, children had a lower ability to wait. So there are many contributing factors, both in genes and in environment, as to delayed gratification capabilities. What they found was an interesting point, is that when they looked at these children again, and they saw what techniques those children did in order to be able to get through this, they noticed that, and you can watch these videos online of the original experiments, you'll see some of the children stare at it for a few seconds, and then they can't handle it, and they eat it. The other children who try to distract themselves, they drum on the table, and they kick their feet, and they look around, and they count their fingers, and they play with toys. There was one particular boy who picked up, it was an Oreo in this experiment, picked up the Oreo and looked around, saw no one was there, and licked out the cream in his middle and put it back with a very pleased-looking smile on his face. It was the ones who were most successful were the ones who were able to distract themselves. Even one girl decided to put her head down on her hands and fell asleep. And that's how she succeeded in delaying her gratification. And what Walter Mischel discovered, he just passed away in the year 2018, what he discovered was a fascinating observation that although it is true that one is born a certain way and then one's environment affects the way one has the ability to be able to exercise patience, at the same time it is a learned skill. And one can teach people how to learn the mechanisms necessary to delay the gratification and not jump in just when one wants to. And that's precisely what's being said over here. Is that in life there are so many things that allure us. There are so many things that pull us. And they look so real, they feel so real, and their taste is so good for all of 3 seconds. But ultimately we spend the rest of our lives living with the results. I was talking to my wife just recently. We went for a walk last week. She mentioned a conversation she had with Ilana Schreier about this topic. And, you know, the person gets onto a new diet, and they say, today's going to be the day, this is going to be the week. And they're busy, and they're running around, they're doing things, and then it comes to 2 o'clock in the afternoon, they didn't plan lunch, and they're passing a pizza place, and what do you think's going to happen? Of course you're going to fall into it, not because we're bad people, but because we didn't plan otherwise. If we don't have a longer-term goal of what we were trying to accomplish, we will fall into the short-term pitfalls of all the things which look so real, feel so real, and are so necessary because of where we are right now. But we know that it really isn't real in life. But it takes some planning to be able to organize that one doesn't fall into that trap. That's the seer, Lazarzel. The realization that the further we look for those things, they weren't really real. I'd like to move on to the Model 2. Model 2 is a rather shocking model, and it comes actually from a comment I heard last week. Last week I was at the funeral of Mrs. Penina Arbisfeld, Aleha Shalom, really a remarkable human being who left this world far too early. And at the funeral, Sokolov made the following observation. I think it's a profound observation. And that is, the halacha is the Gemara in Brachos Daf Nun Chesam Beis tells us, it's Paskin and Shulchan Aruch, that if you don't see a friend for 30 days, when you see them next, you say, Baruch HaShechiyanu. Most people don't know this. If one doesn't see a friend for 12 months, one says, Baruch Machaye Meisim. Blessed is you, Hashem, who resurrects the dead. That's a little bit of a dramatic way of saying, I've missed seeing you. What does that mean? Why is that the case? So it goes back to an incident which occurred in 2009. And this incident I heard about and in such detail from Ari Satcher, one of the inventors, the creators of the Iron Dome systems in Israel. And he actually just sat shivers last week for his father. And I'm mentioning this, Lilu Nishmas, his father, because it was a profound observation that he once made. And I reached out to him this week and mentioned, I'm going to be mentioning and talking about this in the Shabbos Shiva Joshua. It goes back to the day, May 31st, 2009, about an Air France flight 447, leaving Rio de Janeiro at 7 p.m., meant bound for Paris. The flight never arrived in Paris. 5 days later, the wreckage was found floating in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, and the plane had crashed. All people aboard, 230 people, including crew, and all the passengers were assumed dead. It occurred in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, so there was no radio contact both from the South American side or the African side, the Senegalian side, where they had radio contact. And there were a few messages via satellite, but they were more confusing than answering any of the questions. For 2 years, the investigators believed that the plane had crashed because of mechanical failure and the crew's inability to navigate the storm that they were going through at the time. However, 2 years later, with an incredible amount of investment and almost miraculous proportion, they were able to extract the remains of the plane from 13,000 feet below the surface of the ocean and extract the black boxes and to be able to hear the recorder of the flight. Just to take a step backwards and understand what's going on, to appreciate the fact that this flight should never have crashed. The captain of the pilot was a 58-year-old Marc Dubois. He was a Air France pilot who had 30 years of experience, a very well-seasoned pilot with tens of thousands of flying hours beneath his belt. The relief first officer co-pilot in the left seat was a 37-year-old David Robert, and he had joined Air France in 1998, had 6,500 flying hours, many of which were on the Airbus, which was what he was flying. The first officer co-pilot to the right seat was a young man, 32-year-old Pierre-Cédric Bonin, Bonin was had joined in 2003 and it only had 2,936 flight hours. On the same flight, his wife, who was a physics teacher, was also present. And if you listen to the data, if you listen to what was going on in that cockpit, you realize how terrifying it is and how fast this accident occurred. They were moving. They left at 7 o'clock, moving as predicted along the course. They were flying an Airbus 330, which is one of the safest airplanes in existence, an incredible feat of human creation, and is still one of the biggest, one of the most used aeronautical transport units in the world still to today. In fact, it runs 99% on autopilot. The pilots don't need to do too much. It lands by itself. It flies by itself. It takes off by itself. It really is a remarkable airplane. And the rule that happens over here is this wasn't because of a colossal failure, but a cascade of small failures which turned into a problem. They leave at 7 o'clock in the evening. They leave the radar of Brazilian airspace in the mid-evening. And they enter into what's called the convergence zone. Convergence zones around the equator, where at particular times of the year, there are thunderstorms which are more likely, and this is known, and they're starting to enter into a thunderstorm. At this time, the captain goes to take a scheduled rest. He's tired. He goes to take a scheduled rest, leaving the co-pilot and the relief co-pilot in the seats in charge of the airplane. As they enter the thunderstorm, they notice that there is lightning, there's electric charge on the front windows. It's the dark of night, and this is something which is regular and not unusual. But then what happens is the pitot tubes freeze over. Those are tubes which measure both altitude and the thrust and the speed with which the plane is traveling. When this happens, because there's no airspeed, the plane then returns the controls to the pilot. So it turns off autopilot, putting it into manual, and so the pilots now have to guide the plane. But the pilots couldn't gauge how fast they were flying because the tubes were closed. They didn't trust they did not trust the equipment. They did not trust that they were getting the right results. And then you need to have just the right amount, because you fly too fast, you can break the airplane apart. If you fly too slowly, you lose lift, and then the plane falls. What was remarkable in this case in Air France 447 is the pilots did not do what they should have, which is carried on flying and waiting for the tubes to unfreeze and autopilot to kick back in. The relief pilot, Bonin, pulls the plane up. He pulls the stick backwards, tilting the nose upwards, fearing that the controls are not giving him the correct measurement of altitude, and decides that he needs to pull the plane up. And he starts raising the plane. The plane starts going from the regular cruising speed of 35,000 feet and starts reaching 38,000 feet. At the same time, just to understand how this works, is lift is created when the shape of the wing, if you look at a cross-section of the wing, the air is split. The molecules of air are split beneath and above the wing. And a high pressure system is created below the wing and a low pressure above the wing, pushing the wing up. Also, the air molecules which go over the top of the wing push downwards as they come off the edge of the wing and therefore push the plane upwards. That creates lift. That is only possible if the wing is horizontal and facing the wind. When you turn a plane upwards, what happens is most of the air is now hitting the bottom of the wing, not being split over the wing, not creating sufficient lift to allow the plane to go up. That's what's called a stall, an aeronautical stall. And that's what happened. As he pulled the plane up, not trusting the equipment, thinking that they needed to go a little further higher, it created a stall. The plane started losing altitude. But they didn't trust that the equipment was actually telling them the right thing. At this point in time, they had lost their situational awareness. They weren't aware of what was happening. The plane became slower and slower. The wings could not provide sufficient lift, and the plane started falling like a rock. At which point in time, after 56 seconds, the pitot tubes actually now cleared of ice, at which point in time they could have switched back to autopilot and have saved the plane. But they didn't. And this is the tremendously sad part, because they could have saved the plane if they turned down into the fall, creating sufficient lift, and then slowly pulled it up. And yet, through this entire time, Bonin pulled the plane up, making her lose more altitude. They were falling at 10,000 feet a minute. You understand this? This only took a few minutes at the hour 1:04 a.m. as it started. Realizing that they lost control of the plane, they wake up the captain, Captain Dubois, who comes in and, gauging what's going on, calls out to them, and he says, "Pull her up, pull her up." And the co-pilot screams out, "I've been pulling her up for the last 5 minutes." And the pilot screams, "No, no, no," realizing that that's the reason they were falling. And the recordings then stop. It's an incredibly sad description of what happened. And it was unavoidable. It was avoidable, unfortunately. It was an avoidable accident. What one learns from this, after they discovered this black box and heard the recordings, is something what's so poignant is that even the aircraft itself was calling out stall, 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 even though it was not in autopilot anymore. And yet the pilot, who was French, didn't understand what that meant. So many small mistakes which led to the loss of 230 lives. What happens to us in life is that we have autopilots. We have mechanisms and habits which keep us going, and usually it's all right until we hit the storm. And then we realize we don't know how to fly anymore. We don't know how to navigate the situation. We weren't used to dealing with this because we always had these mechanisms. We had this habit in place. I stand on the side of the road, and especially at night, you can see it. Most people are texting and driving. Most people have their phones out, and as they're driving, they're texting, and they're searching, and they're scrolling on their phones. And you know what? Most of the time, people are safe, because traffic continues, and the car in front of them keeps going at a consistent speed, and they keep going based on the half attention that they're giving to the road. It's all right until somebody stops short, until somebody cuts in the lane, and then it doesn't work anymore. Autopilot sometimes disallows us from making the necessary decisions to do the right thing in life. And that's precisely why it is, says the Maharshal, Nakumorim Brachos Daf Nun Ches, why it is that we say Baruch Mechaye Mesim when we see somebody after 12 months. You know, in the Sanat Tokef, we say Mi Yichye Umi Yom, so that critical point, who will live and who will lo'aleinu pass away? Why do we just say Mi Yomus? All we need to say is who won't be here, and then and the people who didn't make that will be alive by default. Says the Maharshal, there's no default. Being alive is not a default. There's no reason to think that because I was here last year, I will be here this year. The lease has to be renewed every single year. Not dying does not mean we're alive. HaKadosh Baruch Hu has to say you are alive. He has to give us life. And therefore, when you see somebody after 12 months, it is inevitable that it has to have been that they had passed a Rosh Hashanah. And if they passed a Rosh Hashanah, that means HaKadosh Baruch Hu resurrected them. He gave them new life, because there is no autopilot. There is no default that suggests that I should be here today because I was here yesterday. And when we live life on autopilot, thinking that we just are because we were, then we treat life in the way that we treat things which are for granted. We don't take advantage of things. We don't close loops. We don't fix relationships because we just are. We'll do it tomorrow. We'll do it another time. And autopilot will ultimately survive until the storm, until it's too late. They tell a story about the fellow who's in the shtiblach, and he's got his tefillin shel yada on in his hand. He's wrapping it up. He's got his tefillin shel rosh on his head, and he doesn't know. Other way around, he has his tefillin shel yada on his tefillin shel rosh, and he's wrapping up, and he forgets. Is he finished davening and he's putting it away, or is he beginning davening and he's putting it on? He doesn't know. And that's the autopilot we lead in life. So many times we say to ourselves, and we think to ourselves, we know where we're going, we know what we're doing, but we aren't even focusing. It's habituated. And a habit is all right, until, unfortunately, it isn't all right. And there's a storm, and the plane crashes, God forbid. This is a window, this is a time where we need to remind ourselves, what are we doing this for? Why are we doing this? Do we know how to fly this plane anymore? Are we taking life for granted? This is the second model. We're trying to understand why it is that we do things which are not helpful for ourselves. I'd like to discuss the third and last model that we're going to address today. And this is based on a Gemara in Rosh Hashanah, which tells us in Tezayin with Aleph that during on Rosh Hashanah, the tzaddikim are already sealed for life. The Rishayim are sealed for death, but the Beinonim, the average people, the people who have a lot of mitzvahs, a lot of averos, and they're kind of, you know, in the middle ground. That's most people, the bell curve. They tefillin vo'emdin. They are suspended between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. That's now, Na'aseres Yemei Teshuva. And if they zahu, if they did extra merits, they broke the tie, they did more merits, then ultimately they'll be nechtamim lechayim. They'll be sealed for a good life. The Rambam, when quoting this in Hilchos Tshuva, quotes this entire Gemara almost verbatim, but he changes one word. The Rambam says that it's not enough just to break the tie. It's not enough to do a mitzvah, an extra act of tzedakah, an extra act of netilas yadayim, an extra act of gemilas chasadim during this period of time. He says that a person who's beinoni, a person who's in the balance, needs to do teshuva. It's not enough just to give tzedakah, which is funny because he's really raising the bar. It's much easier just to give a little extra tzedakah and to break the tie of averos and mitzvahs. But to say that I need to do teshuva, I need to change. Change is hard. Why is the Rambam raising the bar of the Gemara? It goes back to a very important story, a story that occurred many, many years ago in Sefer Shmuel Aleph Perek Hafei. It's a story about David HaMelech. David HaMelech was at this point in time a refugee, running from his father-in-law with a band of 600 men, and he's going from place to place as his father-in-law searches and tries to kill him. At a certain point in time, he spends time in the area of Carmel, and being as he's there, his presence of a military presence in the area, it means to say that there's no pillaging and attacks and raids from the enemies because David HaMelech's men are there. So he turns to the biggest sheep owner in the area, a fabulously wealthy man by the name of Naval, and he turns to him at the time of sheep shearing, also known as pulling in the dividends. You know, now is the end of the season, he's getting his money, and he says, "Listen, it's been a good season. You've had no problem. You've had no attacks from wild animals or raids from enemies because we've been there. We're just going to ask you a basic appreciation is give us a little bit of food to sustain my men in refuge." And Naval turns around and says, "Under no conditions, under no circumstances, I'm not interested." He says, "You do your thing. I'm doing my thing. I don't need you." David HaMelech was so angered. He's a Melech Yisrael. He's the king of Israel. He's asking just for a little sustenance. His men are living in caves. And this man, who's exceptionally wealthy, has no interest in even supporting David HaMelech. David HaMelech pulls out his sword, takes his men, and goes out to encounter Naval with intent to kill him. This man is a Moire B'Malchus, rebelling against the king, and even the way that he conveyed the message was completely inappropriate. David HaMelech goes out, and on the way he's met by the wife of Naval. Her name is Avigail. Avigail comes out, and in the time she heard this had happened from her servants, she saddles tens of donkeys with food, with wine, and she brings it out, and she comes to David and she says, "Oh, please ignore my husband. He's sometimes like that. Kishmo kenhu. He's Naval, he's a disgraceful person. But really, we meant to do better. Look, he has the food. Take the donkeys, take the food and celebrate, but don't allow yourself to be the vehicle of bad." And David HaMelech thanks her. He listens to her. She averts the killing of her husband, and she also averts David HaMelech being the vehicle of a negative outcome, even though perhaps justified. And she comes back home, and she comes to tell her husband what happened, but she can't, because her husband just had a big party, and he's lying drunk on the floor. So she waits till the next morning, and he wakes up, and she says, "By the way, you know, I just saved your life, because I sent all this food to David." And the pasuk tells us in Shmuel Aleph, it says, as he hears what she says, he has a cardiac event, and his heart turned to stone. It was 10 days later. And Hashem plagued him, and he died. Two questions. Question number one: why did he have this heart event? Why did he have this cardiac event? What did this? I always used to think it's because he realized how close a death experience he had just encountered. That's what gave him this event. However, the Radak says no. It was because he was so upset that his wife gave away all those donkeys of food. This miserly rich man, this man who has so much money, so upset that his wife even gave away this thing, has this experience. But the second question, which is a more important question, is why 10 days? Rashi quotes the Medrash that it wasn't just any 10 days. It was Aseres Yemei Teshuva. And perhaps it wasn't that he was even in an unconscious state, as it might seem from the Pesukim. Maybe he was even able, maybe he was cognitive, maybe he was lucid. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave him 10 days in Aseres to make sure between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur to figure out things, to repent, to change his lifestyle, to change and to adapt his character. And he wasn't interested. And he didn't take advantage of it. And he missed that window. And when he missed that window, he died like he deserved to, because he missed making the changes necessary. In life, we sometimes have windows. And if we miss them, woe upon us. The Lechi Mishnah explained, the Rambam says, why is the Rambam says that during Aseres to make Shuvah, it's not enough to do more mitzvahs, you need to do teshuvah. It's not a good to just add zuchuyos. You need to do teshuvah, says the Lechi Mishnah. Because when HaKadosh Baruch Hu comes to us, and on a silver platter says, change, please change, I want you to do better. And we say, oh, you know, Hashem, I'm a little busy right now, maybe I'll get back to you in December. That itself is a terrible avera. Missing the window of teshuvah is an inexcusable avera. Says the Rambam, the only way to get to Aseres to make Shuvah is to take advantage of it. Mitzvahs aren't enough. You have to take advantage of the windows. We all have windows. We all have moments that we feel that we've been called, that we can change, we can be better, we can do better. And yet somehow, we miss them. Yet somehow we don't read those articles which tell us the statistics of what it means to have these products, these foods all the time. That's a problem. There's a man by the name of Rav Shalom Lipska, a Chabad Chassid, who was tasked by the Lubavitcher Rebbe to create an institute called the Aleph Institute. The Aleph Institute takes responsibility to visit and supply and to advocate on behalf of Jewish prisoners across the American penal system. Been around for a number of decades and does an incredible job trying to give chizuk and helping people navigate a very complex system for whatever reason that they're encountering that system. And it was a number of years ago that Rav Lipska and a colleague of his were trying to visit a Jewish inmate in Jacksonville, Florida. Jacksonville, Florida is the middle of nowhere, Jewishly certainly. And they came up and they drove up to visit him, and they'd missed the visiting hours. In the corrective institutes, it's a very punitive. There's no exceptions made. And so they said they needed to visit tomorrow, but the drive was 6 hours from the local Jewish community. So they decided to stay in a local motel. They get to a gas station in the middle of nowhere. And, you know, you can imagine the scene, you know, tumbleweed flying by, nothing really of substance there. The fellow gets out to pump the gas, large, non-Jewish fellow, and the man looks at them, these two Chabad Chassidim, and says, "You, the man you're looking for is in the back." So what do you mean? He said, no, you've got to come with me. And you take around to the back, and the back of the gas station is a desk, you know, a small office where accounts are kept. There's a scrawny man, bald man, sitting behind the desk. Man looks up at them, and in surprise, he opens up his eyes and he sticks out his hand and says, "Shalom Aleichem," in thick Polish Yiddish. And he introduces himself, and they say, what are you doing here? What's the story? And the man says, "I grew up in Poland. I grew up as a Yid. I was brought up in a Belza Kloiz. I was actually an Ilui in the family. Went to Cheder, learned Torah. I used to sing at the Tishas of the Rebbe, and." Then came the war, World War II. In World War II, my father, my mother, every one of my siblings, all my uncles, all my aunts, every cousin of mine was killed. Not a single survivor except for myself. And on that boat, as I came to America, I said, I didn't want to have chelek with this. I didn't want to have to be with a God and a nation, a God who was so absent and a nation who was so persecuted. And I said, forget it. I'm not going to Brooklyn. I'm not going to spend time in the Jewish community. And that was it. That was the last time I thought about Judaism. I went down to Florida, made my way around, and started working for this fellow who owned this gas station. Ultimately married his daughter and bought out the gas station. And he says, "You see that fellow out there who's pumping your gas?" He says, that fellow, that's one of my three sons with this woman." And that's what happens. The man says, "I'll tell you what happened." He says, "Just a little while back, I couldn't sleep at night. And I was thinking back to the days before, because I never told my wife, I never told my father-in-law, my children that I was Jewish. I told them I was a Polish immigrant, and that's what they thought I was, and that was the be-all and end-all. And I couldn't sleep at night. And so I went downstairs to the den, and I was flipping channels on the TV at 11 o'clock at night, and then one channel caught my attention. It was an elderly man, a rabbi, who was sitting in front of thousands of chassidim, and he was speaking. It was a Babbage Rebbe. He was speaking in Yiddish, and there were subtitles at the bottom, but I didn't need the subtitles because I grew up speaking Yiddish. And he was talking to the Hasidim. In the middle of his speech, he turned away from the chassidim and he looked at the screen, and I felt he was looking at me, and he said that even though we try to run away from our yahadus, from our Judaism, and even though we go to the furthest corners of the earth, we will not be able to sleep at night because you know you can't escape your identity. And the Ribbono Shel Olam is going to send Mashiach, and Mashiach is going to pull us away and take us back from all the places that we found ourselves. And I knew that the Rebbe was speaking to me that night. Says, and so when my son, and that night I woke up my children, I woke up my wife, and I said to them, I've got to tell you, I have an admission to make. I told you I was Polish, I'm not Polish, I'm Jewish. They were surprised, and I said, and I want to tell you, it's not your problem, but you should know that I've got a heritage, I come from somewhere. And there's going to be a time when the Mashiach is going to come, the Messiah is going to come, and he's going to take me away, because I am part of something bigger, and it's not your problem, but I need you to know something I need to struggle with, something I need to work through. So when you arrived, my son saw you at the gas station, he said, that's the man you're looking for. They think that you've come to take me away. And that night, he spent the night with the Chassidim, and the Chabad Chassidim, and he sang bells and nigunim of the past for the first time in years. And that next morning, he put on tefillin for the first time since Europe. Very shortly afterwards, he passed away. That was his window. That was his moment. So many of us have moments, and we miss those moments. Like Naval, ignore them. They happen. They arrive. And yet we ignore them. Why do we keep sabotaging ourselves? We keep sabotaging ourselves because of the illusion of what's in front of us right now. It seems so real, even though it's just a mirage. We keep making mistakes because of autopilot. Because we're so used to being on autopilot, and the mechanisms that we created for ourselves are outdated and no longer work, and we forgot that we even need to fly the plane ourselves. And sometimes HaKadosh Baruch Hu sends us hopeful messages. Sometimes HaKadosh Baruch Hu turns to us and says, the reason you can't sleep at night is because you need to change. And sometimes we just turn over, take a pill and go back to sleep. And we ignore that message. And this Shabbat Shuvah, it's not just fun and games. It's not just inspirational thoughts. I'd like to take it, if you could look at the message, the last page on the Shabbat Shuvah Drasha, there's a worksheet, and I'd like you to take this home. There's on that last sheet, three questions. Question number one is about the immediate versus long-term goals. What are the things that I want to be better at in life? What do I know I want to be better at this Aseret Simchat Shuvah while the window's open? And divide it into three categories. Better on the Atzmai, that's the personal aspects of my life. Be'odon l'chavero, social aspects of my life. Be'odon l'makom, my religious aspects of my life. What are things I want to be better at? And now answer the next question. What do I need to be scheduled in my calendar in my life to ensure that they become a reality? It's not enough to be inspired. What am I scheduling? What are tangible steps necessary to make sure that I'm not living in the illusory? I'm not buying the pizza because I have no other choice. Because I made plans already of where to get lunch. I made plans about what I want to be doing this year. The next section, breaking the autopilot. What a moment in the last year that I realized my autopilot system isn't working. The mechanisms of dealing with pain and dealing with other people and dealing with HaKadosh Baruch Hu are not working. Those autopilots are outdated. It doesn't work anymore. And then what do I need to do? What do I need to change in order to start flying the plane again? And number three, what are windows of opportunity? What are windows of growth that are upcoming in this year? It could be Yom Tov, an anniversary, a birthday party, a family get together around Hanukkah. When are those moments, and what are we going to do to utilize those moments? What am I going to do to take advantage of these things? To make it not a year of sabotage, not a year of again doing the things I know are not good for me. The things I know deep down are not going to be helpful. But to choose things that I know are leading to the goals of my life. That are incrementally there, that I'm going to be moving towards the person I truly want to be. Both in my personal life, my social life, and my religious life. Be'ezrat Hashem, may we all be zeichet. Have a wonderful, meaningful day. And a Gemara Chazimah Tov.